Hello, fellow consumers of information. As you may have heard from this and or other trustworthy sources, I'm Nate Bennett, and this is the 13th episode of Chefaleptic, my autobiographical podcast series. Today, I'll discuss the time period immediately following my final phase of seizure study at Stanford, including the music work I dove into during that stretch, as well as the effort it took me to size up the music I had done during the time period before the study. Also, I'll pontificate a bit about a few historical figures that I've both related to and developed respect for as I've learned about how they dealt with their own apparent seizure-causing medical conditions during the times and in the settings in which they lived. If, after ingesting this segment, you found that it was engaging or possibly even enjoyable, and or if it makes you think of someone else who may, make sure to let them know about it. And make it easy for them by sending them a link or at least spelling out the site's name. I'm glad to share this series for free, but it won't pop out at them in ads or envelop them like fads. Chapter 52.
Time Drones.
After I'd moved into Amy's house by the boardwalk, it took a few months to get any kind of music workstation set up, and I finally began to ease myself back into music again. I let myself play old, simple, familiar cover tunes and started trying to sing. I was a little surprised because my voice did sound good, though it seemed to have changed and I had to relearn how to work with it. As I waded into the pool of my previous obsession, I knew that beating myself up right off the bat wasn't the way to get back in touch with my prior skill set, but I had to admit that I didn't hit the dustiest shelf first, that is, the most recent work I had done. Somehow, I knew that I was not totally pleased with Next Times, but I did not know why. So I procrastinated listening to it as long as I could. Later, I'd learn that for a number of reasons, I'd have a big cleanup job on my hands with that one. I instead got into a completely different kind of project, which I was able to do with my computer and a set of headphones, with very little instrument work, because I was using a bunch of material that had been recorded already back when I lived in the apartment. For this thing, I was mostly doing editing and mixing work. The project, which I named Cloning Drones, was culled from about 5 hours worth of noodling and looping tracks from when my old How's Your Day buddy Timothy Butler had visited Santa Cruz from Berlin back in 2011 and again in 2012. My memories of his visits are pretty foggy, but I'd been dragging around the files for a long time because I knew I could make something out of them sometime. Spring of 14 ended up being the time. I got way into making cloning drones because I was able to work with something that was already recorded. It all just needed to be sorted through and cut up and stitched back together, and this gave me the chance to ease back into the world of sound production without constantly being angry at myself for having lousy chops on the instruments. Timothy had been living in Germany for years by that point, and I decided that I wanted to do this project and surprise him with it, if only because likely by then he had every good reason to think that it would probably not end up ever happening. It ended up being a pretty extreme sounding and abstract piece of instrumental and electronic work, and Timothy and I agreed after he heard it that it's unlikely to have commercial potential, so I just posted it online for free listening. It's not music for everyone every day, but I felt pretty sure that it would have its time and place for somebody, so I was glad to share it with whoever might be looking to listen to such a thing. For anyone who might be listening to the podcast version of this book, it's that crazy stuff that I've been using in the background when I describe my seizures. When it was done, I got a hold of him for the first time in way too long, I think. But anyway, I sent him the goods to listen to halfway around the world just to say, "Surprise, brother!" I'm fortunate to have had the opportunity to have learned with my How's Your Day bandmate, who had grown into a true music master over the years. See, I could remember that kind of stuff, just not Next Times. So I finally had to take the big step and listen to that one. Digging through old email helped me figure out that it was started in October 2011 and the CD release party was on May 24th, 2012. I still seem to be doing really badly with this whole time period in my memory. I mean, I knew I made the album and who had worked on it with me, but when I finally listened back to it, I couldn't list any of the details like who did what on what tunes. In fact, I couldn't even list the names of the tracks in order. This damn thing was supposedly finished in 2012, only 3 years before that point, but it seemed like it might as well have been made 30 years before, because I just couldn't recall. I've been able to glean a lot of info about my own history from my saved emails. In case I forget to mention it later, in my still imaginary list of tips for people with memory issues, never throw away your old emails would still get the number one spot for sure. By searching through my years-old email, I managed to scrape out some of the details about the album. I sifted through the communications I could find there from that stretch of time because I'd used that forum a lot to chat about the project with Mike and my other music friends as I'd made it. So, I relearned that I'd begun the project when I was living in that apartment to begin with. I'd managed to pay up whatever my debts were at that moment well enough that I'd figured I could both make the album and afford to print CDs of it if I just compromised a little with the packaging, apparently. I was dealing with the whole stopping driving thing back then and was still managing to keep working while commuting with my bicycle and using the bus. The apartment was cheap and not having vehicles had at least made life a little cheaper. I wasn't using weed or drinking at all during that time and I was clearly bored, lonely, and doing whatever I could to keep away from the pit of despair by coming home from work and writing and recording with my computer. The apartment, as I explained before, was tiny and basically crammed with music gear. So I had recorded whatever I could in the apartment and then arranged with Mike to finish the album by doing stuff that needed good microphoning at Quilted Fish. I was able to handle a good amount of the work at home by using my electronic drums, keyboards, bass, and electric guitar all plugged directly into my recording stuff while listening only on headphones. This had enabled me to work late at night without disturbing the nearby neighbors. I guess, as usual, I was hoping at first to make something I could get others involved in, so just maybe they might possibly want to help me out yet a little more by supporting the album when it was finished. Again, I know I was a hopeless case and all. Anyways, I'd poked and bugged former bandmates for help with it, and ended up working most with NAP veterans Wendy, female vocals, Tim Gard, horns, viola, and mixing, and Brett Wiltshire, bass. Tim Butler from How's Your Day Times had co-written and recorded parts, melodica, acoustic guitar, and vocals for one of the songs from Berlin. I'd done critical microphone recording at Quilted Fish with Mike Fermenti, and he and Tim Gard had helped me mix it up there. I know that at the time I made the album, I was running a pretty basic safety-first routine. Basically, the more time I could spend at my place, the better, because flipping out in public would only greaten the odds that I'd end up in the flush pipe on the whole work thing, and all the other evils that I knew could happen probably then would. Instead, I kept myself busy with my music and writing, hoping there might be some kind of positive results, maybe even, dare I say, some way to make income that wouldn't just stop if I spazzed in the wrong place at the wrong time. At the Boardwalk House, I recovered most of the history and details about that album with research and refresh missions through my old emails and scraps, which I undertook before daring to re-listen to it. Reading about it first somehow had to happen before I could listen to it. I wasn't ready to hear it yet. And doing that kind of research about my own recent past is always weird. Reading back through old email from this other guy I know was me from 3 or 4 years back is often embarrassing and scary. I find that not everything in that email history goes along with happy memories, and not all of the memories from making that album were positive, though most were, of course, because I was communicating with some really great people. Thing is, now that I'm looking back at him, I see the desperate, lonely, and bored bum who was bumbling along trying to rally people to play his tunes. That guy had apparently thought he could just stroll into Quilted Fish with Windy and Tim Gard and nail all the vocals and microphoned instruments for that hour-long album, having done minimal rehearsal in a very short amount of time because the rest of the parts had already been tracked in an apartment. Then, on top of that, I guess the fool thought he'd be able to mix that all up to his delight and then his good old buddy Mike would just master it up real good in another real short amount of time. Of course, real fast and cheap and all. And finally, that loco man figured he'd just get them all printed up and wrapped up and ready to roll with some low-budget printing company. Whew, looks like that didn't work out easy either. Apparently, there were errors with the printing, adding stress because I'd somehow made a stupid deadline by setting up a CD release party. So, the project had ended up under the pressures of both deadline and budget, and when I finally did listen, that was of course part of what I heard. Hearing it was something like when I'd first finished my song, All My Machines, after a long round of seizures years back. I knew it was me, but it was not. It was he, and it was him. And even before I heard it, I knew that somehow he'd let me down with this one, and I was angry at him. With my other albums, even though they never sold any significant amount, I was always proud of them and glad to push them around as far as I can remember. But I had some kind of chip on my shoulder with this one. Was it the material? The songwriting? Did I not remember them now because they sucked so much? Could I not recite more of the material because I was not proud of the core material itself? I was so far from the material that I could not have told you what all I was displeased about before both researching and then finally re-listening to it. I had figured that I'd still be pleased that it was mine after hearing it. I was probably mostly just freaked out by the fact that reading the titles did not make me able to play or recall the material very well. It was so damn recent, but yet it was so lost in my memory. So, when I finally threw it in and listened, I was pleased in some ways, but that wasn't good enough. Really, it sounded to me like a project that was going pretty well, but then got rushed together at the end and came off sounding amateurish and short of breath. So, it was a disappointment. I was, after all, still hoping that I'd put any doubts immediately to rest by hearing it, and unfortunately, that didn't happen. I was displeased with a number of details that all seemed to be things I could and should have noticed and fixed up before calling the project done, yet somehow I'd let myself call it done. Why had I done this? I mean, why had he done that? As I studied it with my first close post-surgery listen, I thought of a grand house being built. Maybe like something Victorian or maybe something ultra-modern. Either way, a lot of time and effort had gone into the design, the materials, the craftsmanship, until right at the end when the deadline came up or the cash ran out and a shitty coat of paint was sprayed over it and a cardboard sign with the word done scribbled on it with a permanent marker was stuck in the front yard. And now, only a few years later, it was standing alone in an empty field with that paint peeling off and it looked like nobody had been around it for years with the sound of the wind howling as a tumbleweed blew by. And one sure had blown by. Since this project had been, quote, completed, Timothy Douglas Gard, who was not only my roommate but also my musical colleague and co-conspirator, had moved on. His death occurred sometime in the late hours of August 23, 2014. After he'd left Santa Cruz, he had lived briefly in Vegas and hated it, and then decided to head for Portland. He had said that he'd thought that the hot weather was bad for his symptoms, and apparently other MS sufferers had agreed with this, so he was going back to the northern realm. Unfortunately, it appears he was not comfortable enough after a short time there to keep sticking around this life. I had cleaned up and buttoned up that house we'd shared, and he had returned some of my stuff that his movers had accidentally grabbed when they came to get his stuff. We were cool. He and I hadn't exactly had a great breakup of our roommate situation in spite of all good intentions and efforts, but we'd gradually had more and more e-contact and were even using some humor there at the end. My last communication with him ended up being a couple of simple texts we'd bounced during that last stretch where I was all wired up and waiting to seize during that third stay at Stanford. He'd heard that Amy and I were engaged, and he congratulated me in his own way. I remember in the last text I'd gotten from him that he'd said something like, "Well, looks like you're going to be all snug bug rug now." I remember searching for the right words that would wish him well, but I knew he wasn't doing well, and he could smell bullshit from a mile away, and that text had ended up being our last contact. As roommates, we'd had numerous conversations about religion and God. He was too smart to believe in any kind of higher powers or greater purposes or designs, but somehow he'd cut me some slack for my beliefs. With both of our mortalities constantly on our minds, I think we both were comforted by having someone to talk to. I know I told him I thought I'd see him again sometime after this life had ended, but he thought that was unlikely. I still hope I end up being the one who was right about that. I'd love to heckle him in the next life if I ever do get the chance to. A few of his Santa Cruz friends finally got together for a nice little wake for him at the beach on a Friday that November. It turned out to be real sweet. A barbecue at sunset on a West Coast beach kind of a thing. I think he would have approved. He'd worked hard on Next Times with me. He'd played a couple of parts, but mostly he helped me with the mix up at Quilted Fish. I know that he did, but not because I remember. It's more because I did that research by going over those old emails and notes, of which there were plenty from when the album was made. Much of the work I still wanted to keep when I listened to the album is work that I did with his help. My scrubbing through my email trail proved that I'd also done a lousy job of promoting Next Times. I'd gotten a reasonable gig together in downtown Santa Cruz for a CD release and put an ad in the local entertainment paper, and that was about it. The album hadn't gotten any real airplay or attention that might have justified making it, but then it hadn't turned out good enough to deserve such attention anyways.
Chapter 53.
How the Pros Don't Do It.
Now, since I had made Next Times, I had not only had plenty more seizures, but also the entire Stanford adventure had occurred. I'd managed to bring my PC into the hospital with me and even a MIDI keyboard, so I was able to do something besides just watching TV. As I poked around on the net, I had managed to find plenty to read about sound production, and I read a number of articles basically about how the pros do it. I had realized that a number of things about my approach to music through the years had kept me from breaking into the zone of making recordings with commercial appeal because I not only didn't know jack shit as I started hitting the record button, but also because, just like learning about music theory, I hadn't eaten my vegetables good enough to have a better understanding of how records get made in the high-end studios that make real hits. With my hopeful hack approach, I instead had to try and fail at just about everything while recording to figure out why what wasn't working. As I surfed and read in the hospital, I thought about what kind of resources an artist with a big contract had to work with, and naturally compared this all to myself. Of course, one can assume that if any artist has landed a big contract, they probably would be starting off having their health in a workable and manageable state, or likely the big company would not take the risk of signing them. Lesson number one is that those big machines always cover their own asses first, every time. After being signed, an artist is also probably then going to be working with some kind of management and some pro production assistants, and they'll likely work with some oversight to make sure that any invested budget is well spent. I couldn't help myself. I read more and more out of sheer curiosity about both business and sound production. What makes a hit sound like a hit anyway? I had already realized long ago that I probably was not going to end up being the kind of artist to nab one of these big deals, but when the seizure diagnosis came along, it had simply made that conclusion seem doubly clear. I'd moved from Michigan to California to be an indie artist, and I was then, and still am, proud of that decision, but regardless whether or not I'd ever be a big rock star, I still wanted to make good-sounding stuff, if only for my friends and family to hear. As I sat at Stanford, though, I couldn't help but try to learn how it's really done. Just how do they make the big hit music in their studios? What tools did they have that I didn't? How are those tools used? What can I say? It's just part of my particular area of fascination, and I had plenty of time to kill while trying to stay up all night and skip meals and everything else I did to trigger seizures so the doctors could watch. Later, at some point after that last phase at Stanford had ended, Amy and I watched a drama documentary about one of my hero bands from when I was a kid. It told the story of how that band had come together and gotten super famous, but it also included a bit about them meeting a famous industry producer who ended up working with them through the years to make many hit recordings. This producer was actually behind lots of big hits from that era, so I was really fascinated, but it really pointed out what the big stars had to work with in the studio that I just plain did not. One of the conclusions I had already come to at some point was that the biggest gap between me and Quilted Fish versus the resources the recording industry has to work with is the sheer amount of time that can be spent in the studio. Over the years, Mike had equipped his studio with more and more nice mics and recording tools, and whatever rehearsed performance was brought up there and executed well could be captured well. However, getting there, getting the recording time set up, and having Mike or another capable person to sit at the mixing board for little or more likely zero pay had no chance of being near or equal to the resources that were spent making some of my favorite albums, some of which supposedly took years of high-end studio time with teams of specialized engineers to make. Of course, being a proud idiot and all, I had always chalked up these differences between my indie setup and the major recording industry to my simply not being good enough and needing to work harder. So, before I re-listened to Next Times, I knew that all of that recent reading and pondering was hanging around in the background of my mind. I probably knew already that I'd finally hear Next Times and be disappointed that it didn't sound like a million-dollar album, despite whatever efforts and chump change had been put into making it. After all, if it sounded that good, I wouldn't still have had cases of copies of it, and I knew it. But I still held out hope that those boxes of CDs would still end up meaning something and being worthy of sharing. And as it turned out, they almost were. Almost. So, as a total outsider, basically listening to someone else's project, I listened with a tough and critical ear. As I listened, I realized that most of all, I wanted to rewind and spend more time in the studio polishing up the vocals. I wanted to have more time to record more layers of harmonizing backing vocals. More time for more of those studio tricks that go into making albums that sound better than demos, most of which involve the vocal parts. But the songs didn't suck. The words did break through to me, but they'd probably only have demanded the attention of a total stranger here and there, where more time had been spent on layering and making sure the music and rhythm aspects of the performances were all perfect before saying Keeper and Next. Now that I was hearing it more like somebody else's work, my ear also wanted to simplify some things by moving some bits around a little more and tidying up sections that were just too cluttered up. And ironically,
The weakest track was the damn title track. It also happened to be the longest track. What the hell had I been thinking? The thing was like 10 minutes long and had plenty of hot licks and good ideas, but it was like the editor-in-chief took a vacation. A pro producer would likely have handed me a pair of scissors and said, "Come back with a third of this." Naturally, if some radio DJ ever had thrown the CD in and picked one track, they'd assume the damn title track would be a good first pick to try, and then they'd probably have faded it down and pitched the album in the trash. Many problems were arrangement related. Most parts were played well enough, but when stacked up, they had made the mix sound cluttered. The result was that in many places, the instruments were distracting from the words, which are really ingredient number one for listeners. It took till later on for me to figure out another crazy element that had caused many problems too: my recording software. As it turned out, a glitch had introduced lots of problems at the final step, when mixes are bounced into a completed stereo track. What this meant was that essentially, once a song's mix was called done to the point where there was enough of this and not too much of that in the studio, the big final combine button had actually introduced errors, so what ended up on the CDs wasn't even the same product that had been called done in the studio. It took me lots of backtracking to figure that one out, but by then, of course, it was beyond way too late anyhow. Finally, I'd rushed through the final polishing steps. I couldn't help but notice that some of the tracks were louder than others, and some tracks were too quiet in some spots, an acknowledged main symptom of amateur work. These final adjustment steps, which are used to make a project sound consistent throughout and most comparable with the industry, are one of the number one reasons serious projects almost always use specialized separate facilities for a process called mastering, which is done by someone who specializes in this kind of work. My previous two albums were mastered at separate mastering facilities, a step which usually costs more than $1,000 for each album, but we had done the mastering for this project on our own, again, under those pressures of deadlines and budget, and it showed. The album didn't sound terrible, it just sounded too homemade, and both the ears of any recording connoisseur or those of any normal listeners could tell whether or not they'd know why. Add to that the fact that it was in this little money-saving cardboard slip jacket, and you've got all you need to keep it from ever having a chance of being taken seriously. By now, I had 3 or 5 boxes crammed with this damn project to lug around with me, and I was not proud enough of it to push them, even if I did find the energy, including rebuilding my voice and instrument skills well enough to consider doing so. I was pretty sure, however, that I could improve the album to the point where it would be worthy of my pride and with minimal effort compared to the combined efforts of everyone who had contributed to it. I was burned by knowing that I'd already let these great people down by releasing it when I was not yet proud enough of the product when I had called it done. What could I do? After all, I was caught off guard more than once as I listened to the occasional really good sounding spots. When it did poke through into sounding like a real pro high-end production for a moment here and there. The writing also got me here and there. It was like that guy in my past was writing to taunt me or poke me now somehow. Some of those lyrics really exposed him to me and helped me find him again. A little bit. He was me, after all, and as I listened, I could remember some of the time I spent writing those songs, especially when I heard the song A Ride. I remembered how I was having to face how much I was going to miss riding my motorcycles once I'd finally decided that I couldn't justify driving anymore. As I'd written it, I had wanted to remember and celebrate all my great memories from my years of riding without just feeling sorry for myself during that dark time. It's a kind of old-fashioned and sad song, but it really had ended up with a grand feeling to it. I remembered the feeling of victory I'd gotten when I finished writing it in that lonely little apartment. Then, there was all those instrument parts on the album. Who was this on the drums? Some of them sounded really fucking good. Oh, wait, that was me. I played those? Damn. And damn. Listen to that guitar part right there. He did have some skills after all. He just needed a little control, maybe. And check out this harmonica part and that piano or synth or sampler part. Turns out, whether I like it or not, he was still a better player back then than I am now, years later, even though I'd still like to think I could once again regain those skills. And I realized, back in 2014, that I wanted to fix that album someday. So I took all of my cases of copies of it and threw them into a nearby dumpster. In that little home studio I had put together in that house by the boardwalk, I opened up all the song files on my computer and realized that I could greatly improve the album just by using the parts that had been recorded for it. That's when I decided that someday, if I had the chance, I'd rebuild it from those tracks. And while I knew that it still wouldn't sound like a big, high-dollar recording industry product, it could yet become something better, something I'd be proud of. And I knew that if that ever did happen, I'd call the new and improved version Better Next Times. Chapter 54.
Heroes in History.
Over time, as I've read more and more about seizures, I've also gradually noted an always growing list of people throughout history that were also known to have had seizures. I'm sure it's probably fairly normal for people to do that with any disease that they get told they have. We want to know if anybody else somehow managed to win with that same particular hand of cards we find ourselves looking at. One thing I've realized is that not everyone always agrees on the whole retrodiagnosis thing. As more gets learned about a person or community that suffered from some kind of medical problem, more educated and specialized people will line up in agreement, but there's often at least somebody disagreeing who sometimes makes their argument with compelling and educated reasoning. I've found that a number of times, a historical figure that I had read was a seizure sufferer had been misdiagnosed, possibly even slandered at the hands of someone telling their story later on. That's the thing about history. It's only as real as the teller can tell it and the reader can read it, with however much time going by in between. Some figures seem to have stronger modern-day acknowledgement and agreement about their seizures, like Vladimir Lenin, the first premier of the Soviet Union, who died in 1924 following a 50-minute round of status epilepticus. Other figures are reflected on with gradual agreement of misdiagnosis by association, like Isaac Newton, whom someone had written criticism of which called him mad and referred to seizures as a slanderous remark. So, the list is a flexible thing that can be argued about, and I'm not an expert, just a consumer. Seizures seem to have an odd place in history. Sometimes they are described as afflicting characters that otherwise seem tough and strong, like Napoleon, Alexander the Great, Harriet Tubman, and Julius Caesar. Sometimes they are a described affliction of characters that have important, even religious, visions, like Muhammad, Joan of Arc, and Socrates. Often, people acknowledged to have had seizures are creative, like Neil Young, authors Lewis Carroll and Edgar Allan Poe, and composers Tchaikovsky and Handel. Sometimes, seizures have had direct impacts on the works that these figures produced. It's when you read all different lists from all different sources that you really get a sort of generalized character view. As I've gradually learned to understand the different varieties of seizures better, I've found myself naturally drawn to the stories of others in history that may have had experiences similar to my own. As there are many kinds of seizures, I find myself most fascinated and enchanted with stories of people who had seizures most like mine. I have more recently come to learn about and have some seizure respect for author-philosopher Fyodor Dostoevsky, who lived from 1821 to 1881. He fascinates me in several ways. For one thing, it sounds like, medically speaking, we likely had a comparable pattern and variety of seizures. Of course, there is no way to prove such a thing, because apparently my particular type of seizure disorder is really rare and all, but it appears that the history that describes him speaks of similar seizure activity. Several of his books contain main characters that have seizures, and their stories are considered to be sort of semi-autobiographical. He spent 8 years in exile in Siberia for reading and circulating banned materials in Russia with his pals in the Petrashevsky Circle. Apparently, he was to be executed, but at the last moment, a stay of execution came from the Tsar. This punishment pattern was supposedly becoming known as a false or mock execution, used as a way to scare as much shit as possible out of someone before letting them live, and then maybe just locking them up for a while. With this guy, I have found myself having much respect for his place and time in history and how he managed his situation. Most of all, how he managed to keep himself alive while figuring out how to feed his family between his seizures. Back in his time, of course, medicine was nowhere near as advanced as nowadays, and his fits were seizures that included an aura phase, which for him was super exciting and even euphoric, but led into a grand mal phase that sounds as though it led to lots of different partial phases of seizures. Kind of like mine. He apparently found himself with a heavy amount of debt in Russia and had moved himself and his family around to evade his debtors. Meanwhile, he wrote like crazy and kicked out like 11 large novels which entangle epilepsy-related scenarios galore. In his works, a line gets tested that I know I've had to draw for myself, the intentional misrepresentation of one's own seizures. Any discussion of that odd boundary catches my eye because at some point in my life I've made my own decision that I could never intentionally let myself say that I had any seizures when I knew I hadn't. That's a card I had decided I would not, and still don't, let myself play, perhaps out of superstitious or karmic beliefs, although I've been tempted to many times. Sometimes I think that making this decision was one of the better steps I had started to take when I realized what I was up against. Seizures that could happen at any time, cause me to lose time, and possibly to stay gone for longer lengths of time, perhaps eventually forever. I remember back to something my old bandmate buddy Zoltan had told me many years ago. His family is of Hungarian descent, and he had mentioned that there was some kind of old world adage wisdom kind of phrase along the lines of what would translate in English to, "You don't paint the devil on the wall." I had thought back to that very statement as soon as I'd begun to put together what my pattern of seizures could influence me to consider doing and saying, especially once I had learned just how dangerous my seizures could be. I never used them as a false excuse to call in sick or to tell anyone in the world of medicine that was rating the severity of my condition that I had suffered from any seizures during a time when I knew I had not. I just dare not go there myself, though apparently Dostoevsky had also considered this boundary. As I've watched the forefront of neuroscience in hopes that I'd be able to benefit from its rapid advance, I've realized more and more that we do know much more now than we did not so long ago about the brain and how it works and malfunctions. No wonder there have been so many generalizations and misdiagnoses, and no wonder at different times in history, people who were known to have seizures were treated as an outsider group by societies. Not that long ago, what we now call PTSD was called shell shock, and what we now call seizures was called the falling disease, often lumped together with all kinds of neurological disorders under the general banner of madness. My seizures have been so varied and so bizarre over time that I can only imagine that this would have been my classification had I been born around the time of another of my highly esteemed and likely fellow seizure sufferers of the past, Vincent van Gogh, who lived from 1853 to 1890. Like me, he appears to have had good times and bad times as his seizures came and went. His younger brother Theodore lived with him and looked out for him for much of his adult life, enabling Vincent to get that, now precious, painting time. My bro was my roommate for a number of years and also has helped me manage as well, which enabled me to keep a job and work on my music. And also like mine, Vincent's well-meaning younger brother eventually found himself unable to help. Unlike me, in Van Gogh's time, there were far more primitive diagnoses and tools for doctors. He ended up being treated with bromide, which in his era was the thing for controlling grand mals, and as it was used more and more to treat him, it became less effective. He gradually grew a taste for the then popular combo of absinthe with alcohol, and he'd often be institutionalized when he'd have seizures, which happened to him more and more often as he grew older. It appears that when he'd start flipping out, he'd be restrained for however long until he'd chill out, and then he'd bounce back to a normal pattern until he'd start flipping again. It would have been really hard to be in his brother's situation. Theodore clearly did everything he possibly could have to make his bro's life as good as it could have been in light of what Vincent was going through. I've managed to learn something from Mr. Van Gogh that is a more subtle lesson, harder to put into simple words. It has taken me both reading about his life and seeing how his work grew and changed along with his experience to have the sympathetic appreciation I've developed for his character. It doesn't seem that he had a very happy time overall, yet he managed to turn to his talent to leave behind brilliant and inspirational work that is considered to be some of the most groundbreaking and innovative art ever created. He had a place to put his pride, and he made such important work because he learned first and then used the tools he had perfected to cross over into a new way to communicate and convey emotion visually. He had done his time becoming a master, and his early work is clearly all about painting exactly what he saw, from the still-life bowls of fruit to the very realistic and literal-looking portraits and pictures of streets and buildings that he learned to represent with almost photographic integrity. The guy clearly learned how to paint, and paint well, before he took the big steps that seemed to move from painting with his eye to painting from his heart. His later works broke into what the art world eventually called Impressionism, meaning that it was characterized by being focused on the virtual impression of a moment, capturing a feeling or experience, rather than making a more literal, accurate depiction of what the artist is looking at as they work. However, it may have been affected by his medical situation, his work seemed to gradually cross over into a more effective, emotionally conveying form. He had left behind needing to prove his skills and just let himself paint what he was feeling somehow. And even when what he was representing was a somber or humble subject, he's repeatedly been called out over time for showing some amount of optimism. History seems to describe what would be a very lonely and scary set of circumstances for Mr. Van Gogh leading up to the end of his life. Somehow, what for me has managed to at times miraculously improve for some lengthier stretches of time, for him just kept getting worse and worse. While his brother did everything he could have ever been asked to do for him, his sickness still worsened with more and more episodes of delirium and self-destructive behavior. Like many situations in history, we can't be sure that Van Gogh was suffering from epilepsy of whatever kind of form. He may have been dealing with anything that can cause such degradation, and at his time, those who treated him did not have the same definitions to work with that we have now. Somehow, though, it does make sense that he was facing some of the same kinds of issues that I have. Despite whatever darkness he had faced, Mr. Van Gogh's life ended in a sad, dramatic, melancholic, and somehow yet romanticizable situation, as he somehow managed to turn whatever suffering he'd grappled with into work that is lasting, beautiful, and inspiring. I was also a lonely artist for many years, as the prospects were getting worse and worse for me. Somehow, though, everything took a turn toward the light.
This concludes episode 13 of Shuffleptic. New free episodes are posted weekly on Mondays. All music used in this series is original. To both start and wrap up this episode, I used music that originated on the project that I discussed at length during it, my 2012 album, Next Times. The tune at the beginning was the title track, and this tune at the end here is called A Ride. I'm very proud that I can now say that as of spring of last year, 2020, I completed a major personal mission by reworking this album into its new reborn form, and it is now, finally, Better Next Times. Like all of my albums, it's available right here at natebnt.com for the low, low price of absolutely nada, zilch, nothing, otherwise known as free. You can listen to and even download it by simply going to the music section of this site and clicking on the stairs, then going to the albums section. I'm both proud of and grateful for all of the great friends that made this album with me. One whose voice stands out clearly on it is my true friend and awesome supporting force, Wendy Lang, also known as Manifesta. I don't care what the world awards or ignores, Wendy, you are a fucking star to me. I'm also sharing plenty more of my tunes for free at this site, as well as at numerous other free music sites. Just poke around using artist name NateBNT. Think Better Next Times. If you're new to my music, I recommend that you try the mixtapes section here at natebnt.com, because the playlists there are customized to fit moods that might best fit your current or desired state of mind. A blog, printed version of this series is also posted weekly for those who'd prefer to read, with new episodes also added on Mondays. For a sources cited reference list for each episode, check at the end of the blogs. I've been making an ongoing effort to make sure these lists are as complete and accurate as possible. Till next Monday, keep working with what you have, and if you don't have what you need, don't stop doing whatever you can with whatever you do have to get what you need. This is both your privilege and your obligation when you are free.